Welcome to DevMode.fm, a podcast dedicated to the tools, techniques, and technologies used in modern web development. I'm Andrew Welch from NY Studio 107.
I'm Jennifer Bloomberg from Next Solutions in New York.
I'm Ryan Ireland from CraftQuest.io.
And today we have on Eugene, an InfoSec consultant. How you doing, Eugene?
I'm fine, thanks.
And are you, I know you're in the InfoSec world, so it's lots of mystery and cloak and dagger, but are you able to disclose your location even generally?
Yes, I'm in Europe, Romania. There is nothing to hide. So
nothing to hide. All right, cool. So we have you on here today, Eugene, because we wanted to ask you about InfoSec and kind of curious about what that is. So if you are off in the Yucatan in Mexico and you're trying to buy a Jaguar whistle from a salesman at Chichen Itza, and he asked you, you know, what is InfoSec anyway? What would you tell him? He's blowing the whistle. He's getting impatient. He's blowing it in your ear. You want to give an answer to shut him up. So what is InfoSec?
Something that protects you from something.
So it's kind of the like when I think of InfoSec, I think of kind of the cloak and dagger of the computer world where hackers are constantly trying to break into stuff and people are trying to prevent them from doing it. So you're one of the guys that is trying to prevent people from breaking into stuff. Is that right?
Correct. So to give you a bit of background, basically the security things are for me like a hobby. Mm. And it's been 20 years with this hobby, and more in the past few years, I got to get working on security projects. It's not always what you hear about. In my world, it's different other story. I mean, there are a lot of parts related to security. It's not only someone that tries to break you and someone that tries to fix or protect. It's I've been in different roles, starting with security operations, so which basically is that part where when there is an incident, you need to identify the source and how that issue appeared. So, and I'm not speaking only about application here. It can be, let's say, someone lost his computer that has some personal and confidential things. So you need to remote wipe that computer, things like that. Or can be to identify how an application got broken and how someone was able to get inside of a company. And it's not always that bad. Mm. For me, it's time consuming. And I've been on both sides of this. So.
Oh, so you were a black hacker at some point too, breaking into stuff. Is that what you're telling me?
No. I'm telling you that I know how is to be on the company side, that someone breaks you and you need to understand how the hell did that happen. Got and it. I've also was able to be on the other part as the person that breaks stuff. So I kind of know that both stories.
So I mean, I was kidding, but it's actually not crazy because there are a lot of people that start out as hackers. Mm-hmm. And either they get caught or whatever, and then they end up being security consultants. Like it's right, a thing. Right. You know, a lot of people heard of that movie Catch Me If You Can, and John Abagnale ended up being a consultant for the FBI. And there are other cases of famous mm-hmm. hackers who ended up becoming because they know it so much better, you know?
Yeah. And now it's more and more like this. So if you are a hacker and you are able to break in some company and you can prove yourself, then there is a high chance you can get hired. And I think it's good. I mean, it's not like 10 years ago when someone was doing something and you could have the police at your door. So now it's a bit different.
Well, it depends on the scale of what you do, right? I mean, there are some things you could definitely still have the police at your door, right?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah. But I think it's more simple now. If you want to break something, for example, if you want to try to hack PayPal or Yahoo, you can do it. I mean, they have programs and they have a scope and they give you some endpoints and you can attempt to do whatever you want there. And if you find anything, you can get paid, which is better, I think, than doing stuff by your own. And I mean, I bet there are guys that do it this way and the other way where they can get caught and have big problems. Depends on what target you pick.
So that's an interesting question to me, because my background, I mean, I do know a little bit about the way kind of the underground works, or at least used to work in the kind of hacking into stuff world. And I can get into that later if anyone's interested, but I do know there's a little bit going on back there, right? Mm-hmm. But what I'm curious about is it better as a consultant to be someone that is hired by companies to try and penetration test their software or their website or whatever? Or can you actually make money by just doing it randomly and then trying to get a bounty? Like, it would seem like the bounty way, just it seems like that would not be a wonderful way to make a living, but I don't really know.
Yeah, I can answer on that topic. So there are guys that now do bug bounty full time, and there are a couple of them that are millionaires. So it's, if you are good enough, you can make a living out of this. So there are a lot that do this these days. But for me, I wouldn't quit my job and day-to-day things, right? Because it's tough to make a living only out of this, because you can get lucky, you can make 10k's 20k's in one night, but you can have months when you don't find anything. So it depends how good you are.
It sounds to me kind of like being a gold prospector in a way. Like back in the day, hundreds of years ago, the gold rush, you go out there with your pan and it's just this grueling, terrible hard work. But every now and again, someone's going to strike it rich and discover like the thing that will make them rich for life, you know? And it sounds like this would kind of be that way, in that you've got to be sifting through a whole bunch of stuff, trying to get like the golden prize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's similar. I think there are, I mean, the guys that I follow and I look what they post and what they do, they have at least 5 years doing only this. So it's a different story. But maybe last 2 years there are more guys or girls, I don't know, that maybe they are not so experienced, but they have a lot of time. And I mean, I cannot compete with someone that has 16 hours per day to spend on hacking. No, I mean, it doesn't make sense. But I think I can compete with the experience that I have. So
sure. Nobody has more time than anybody else, right? It doesn't matter who you are. You have the same amount of time. It's how you are going to choose to spend that. And I understand, like, I wouldn't want to spend 16 hours a day working at a corporate job. Like, that just wouldn't, that would not, I couldn't do it. It wouldn't work for me. Like, I totally get it.
I think maybe I should mention about the age also, because I'm 36. I wouldn't put a lot of time on this anyway. But there are kids 13, 15 years old that are rich already, and they have the time to, they don't care about school. They don't need to. For us and for me, it's a bit different,
right?
This thing.
Well, it's easier when you're younger. I mean, I know, because I started my business when I was in my teens. Like, I started doing computer work for money when I was in my teens. And when you're living at home with your parents, like, you have, you've got such a free ride. You have no expenses, you know? So you have zero overhead and all the time in the world, as you're mentioning. Like, you can just do
and no pressure.
No
pressure.
And no pressure.
Yeah. No family, no kids, no. I mean, it's a different story. Yeah. I mean, I would like to have what's now 20 years ago on this scene, but it is what it is.
Right.
You cannot turn back the time.
Well, so let's get into what you actually typically do. So for a typical job, I would imagine you're hired by a company, and it's probably going to be one of two things. It's either going to be help penetration test to make sure that everything is secure, and that's kind of like a maintenance kind of thing. And then on the other hand, it will be, we've been compromised. Oh, crap. Come in and evaluate what went wrong. Is that right? Is it usually one or the other of those? And then describe how those work.
No, I think
no.
It's not, at least for me, it's not. I mean, I'm not that kind of guy that does this for a living. But others that do bug bounties and penetration tests, yeah, I think that's the correct way. For me, I'm in consulting. I do DevOps mainly and security operations. And on the security part, mainly I spend quite some time on threat modeling applications. So I have discussions with developers, and I try to give them pointers. Depending on what they do there, I tell them, look, you should avoid doing that. So that's threat modeling. Basically, I'm in the process when the application is developed and I'm able to discuss with developers and I'm aware a bit of what they do, and whatever can get exposed to the internet, then I can say, look, you have inputs and outputs. Basically, wherever in the browser you input something, you need to be cautious, which was the case.
I've gone from being cautious to completely not trusting anything that is coming from the browser, you know, based on what has happened. So are you doing code reviews, or are you just giving them best practices? Or
yeah, I do code reviews also. Best practices. Actually, in the threat modeling world, you have defined some methods, for example, CSS, cross-site scripting, or other methods. So I'm just trying to say, look, these are the methods that can appear in this portion. So then I am trying to help them don't miss things there. And then, so this is like in the software development part. And once the application is ready, I can do pen testing and try to break it from the, I don't know, browser and so on.
So you go in there and it sounds like you do code reviews, but you also do kind of education, because you can be a really good developer, but still be very naive about the type of things that people might try to do to break your stuff, right?
To be honest, I'm not a developer. I mean, I don't spend time developing, but I understand the code a bit. I mean,
right.
So if I don't get it, I can ask. But I never consider developing because, I don't know, maybe I don't like it too much.
Right, but you aid. Oh, my God. Everyone here is just like, yeah, we don't like it either. You don't do it for a living. So this kind of, Jennifer, this reminds me of my son to an extent. Like, he's only 9, and so he doesn't understand the way things work. But, man, does he probe stuff, presses every button. And so he's discovered stuff just by probing around and doing stuff that I didn't even know existed. Like, I had no idea that some of this stuff was a thing. But, Jennifer, when you're developing stuff, is InfoSec or security ever something that is forefront in your mind? Or does it depend on the project? Or how does that work for you?
Yeah, it's always at the forefront because most of the work that I do is with clients who have sensitive information to protect. And I am aware that the internet is kind of a wild, wild west where people can go and rattle your door handle and check and see if they can break into your house. And if they can do that, well, they're pretty much going to be able to get away with it. There have been so few cases where people have been caught and punished for doing such a thing. Even in my own experience, we had one obscure donation page that someone in Brazil discovered and was using it to check stolen credit cards. Once we discovered it, we reported the IP to, I can't remember who it was, whoever was responsible for it. They did absolutely nothing. So I'm aware that we kind of have to have our own private security to make sure that nothing bad happens to it. And we're talking very, very sensitive data, like data on children and their health and things like that. So it's something that we lose sleep at night over.
Sure.
We pay a outside firm to do penetration testing, and we try to train the clients as well. You know, things like don't leave your laptop open at a coffee shop, those kind of things that they can help with. But
don't make your password be password 123.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So all of these things are top of mind, but it's kind of like an arms race that I'm not very comfortable with because there's always something new to worry about. That's why this conversation is very interesting to me, because I feel like we're probably not doing what we should be doing, even though I think we do a lot more than what most people do.
Eugene, how much of what you do, piggybacking on what Jen was talking about, how much of what you do is proactive, like Jen was talking about, like they do, versus reactive, like when there is a problem? Are you more, you're consulting more into trying to proactively prevent companies from having problems?
Yeah, this is a good question. So yeah, definitely I'm on the proactive side of things. But even with all the protections and all the measures that take, there is always something that appears. So I mean, it's tough. I haven't found the secret sauce, to say like that, to be fully protected. because every time something appears.
But if you were talking to that guy who was selling you that Jaguar whistle and he wanted you to put a percentage on it, how much of the work that you do is preventative and how much of it is reactionary after the intrusion has already happened?
I think 70-80% is preventive.
Okay.
But maybe it's because of this company that I do consulting, because they are in business that it's very important to have the right controls and measures to stop any kind of attack.
And is your work that you do, Eugene, is that in conjunction with an existing IT team? I know a lot of people have, you know, there's like a lot of companies have, obviously they have IT teams, but sometimes they also have people with domain expertise in IT security. Do you come in and kind of augment that, or do you mostly work with software development teams?
No. So depends. I mean, I've been in different roles, either in the security operations, SecOps, and there was a team that mainly was trying to prevent and solve whatever issues appear. And that team also trying to make sure there were enough tools to protect, so the proactive side of things. So that's one part. And I've also been in teams like application security, and that's more on the development process. Now, it depends. I guess I got lucky with this company that I was able to shift from different roles.
You know what I'm interested in? Both Ryan and I are very much interested in the belly of the beast. So the belly of the beast is kind of the dark underside of the world. So what I'm curious about, I'm going to give you my understanding about this, but what I want to know is, like, why are people doing this? What do they get out of hacking? We all read in the news about all of these databases have been leaked and all this information's been leaked. These credit cards have been leaked, you know, et cetera, et cetera. My understanding about the way that some of this works, and a lot of it is very dated, so I'm curious to hear your updated take on it. But my understanding is there's almost like a bizarro world of what you do, where there are bounties for exploits, for instance, where on the black market, people will get paid for exploits that can hack into various things, and those, you can actually sell those things, whether it's an iPhone hack or whether it's a particular version of Linux or whatever. Is that the way that it works? Is that there's sort of a black market where people are doing the opposite of what you're doing, like literally you, but from the opposite angle?
Definitely there is a black market. I'm this from what I've been reading. I mean, there are guys that find the exploits and sell them, but from my perspective, you kind of need to know to whom to sell, because you cannot just put it on a website. So it's a bit tricky. It's like you steal a Mona Lisa paint and okay, what do you do with it?
Yeah, so, now what?
Yeah, exactly.
But my understanding is on the dark web, there are sites that kind of like, I mean, the Silk Road existed for a while, not that, but something like that for security exploits that they can just be kind of bought and sold anonymously.
Yeah, there are. I'm not aware how to do that. But
it's okay, Eugene, you can just pretend and say that a friend told me that this is how it works. So. Okay.
Yeah, I don't have such a friend. there are sites. I think maybe Onion or something like that, but I don't know the process.
But I remember, though, back in the day, back before Fire was invented and computers were brand new and all that kind of stuff, that when people were trying to hack stuff, and usually like the hacker community was centered around games primarily, like a long time ago, back when floppy disks were actually a thing, you know? And what their goal then was really just to putting graffiti on a bridge. They wanted to tag it and they wanted to get the credit that this hacking group did XYZ. And for a long time, there wasn't really any money involved. There was just kind of the street cred that you were able to crack this game. And then, you know, it was a parallel world of people trying to protect stuff and people trying to hack into it. And the people trying to protect stuff were pretty much always acting reactively. You know, they're kind of chasing the people that were hacking stuff. But at some point, when real money became involved, crime syndicates got into this, you know, where they were actually paying people to do this kind of thing. And we've heard about situations where computers are taken over and they encrypt everything. And then they force them to pay ransoms in order to get it unlocked. And it's just kind of fascinating to me that it's a parallel upside down world where people are doing the opposite of what you're trying to do. And they're trying to make money too, but by exploiting something that they have found. And my understanding is that there are a couple different levels of it. So there's still people that just do this recreationally where they're just like, you know, I want to see what I can hack into and maybe I'll put my name on it and that'll be cool enough for me, you know? And then there are people that try to do it professionally where they actually try to make money from it. But how do they make money? So when I compromise a whole bunch of Windows machines and I can turn it into a botnet, for instance, I mean, I understand that I could be playing Fortnite and DDoS my opponent to try and beat him, but that's kind of lame. You know, how would I actually make money if I had penetrated a bunch of computers and had a botnet? Do you have any insights to that?
I don't know how to make money with that.
Maybe we should ask Patrick.
They can send spam emails. They could run a spam botnet. They could
start mining
Bitcoin. They could
hack a SEO plugin.
Already mentioned. Sometimes they probably are doing it because of some principle that they have. They think they're doing the right thing because it's a company that they don't believe is doing good in the world and they want to take it down, or perhaps they have a grudge or both. And sometimes they're doing it. I know of one case where it was a revenge. The person was angry at the company and wanted to do it. Wow. And we also had one client where the data was very, very sensitive and it was a personal issue that he had with a family member and wanted to find information about that family member and just went on a, you know, lone cowboy in the wow. internet and tried to figure that out. But my suspicion is that most people do it just because they can. They there's no punishment very rarely in any case, and they get a kick out of it. They're just going around trying to break into things because they're hooligans.
Well, and I think that Eugene made an interesting point that it may depend on their age too, because when you're young, I think a motivation would just for attention or to feel powerful. Like, can you imagine how empowering you must feel if you're a 15-year-old kid that's, you know, sitting who knows where in the world just with a computer and you're able to deface like a major corporation's website? You got to feel super powerful, I would think. You know, exactly. I bet you that's one motivation.
Yeah. I think when you're a kid, that's a good point. Motivation and trying to show off. But when you're when your age is a bit higher, I think money is the key. I mean, definitely people do it for money.
Yeah, then you want to pay the mortgage, right? You don't care that your name is up there. In fact, you probably don't want any publicity at all.
Exactly.
You want zero publicity. But the funny thing is we used to call people like this, we used to call them script kiddies, right? So these are the people, they are not the people that have done the hard work actually figuring out the exploit. Exactly. They are not the ones with, you know, the knowledge of buffer overflows and all that kind of stuff that are able to make the exploit happen. What they do is, so the one person will actually crack it. And again, maybe they won't even want credit for it. Maybe they don't even want to be linked to it. But they'll release this hack into an underground community and then all these script kiddies will just pick it up. And they won't even know how it works.
Exactly.
But they will be the ones doing the exploit a lot of the times, right?
Exactly, yeah. So I can share a bit how it was with CEOmatic and the plugin.
Or
I shouldn't.
No. It's totally fine. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Go ahead.
So I think beginning of...
So let me set you up first, Eugene. So my first contact with you was on Twitter, and you were telling me about a client site, and you pointed out this vulnerability in SEOmatic, and that's how you and I started talking. So yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. That was beginning of this year, I thought, let me see what's with this bug bounty platforms. And I set a scope to see if I can find anything. So it was January. I spent time on trying to see how things are working and didn't find anything useful. And then I got an invite for to be able to do bug bounty on a site. It was a private program. Not everything is public when you do bug bounty. So I got invited, and luckily, I guess that site was running Craft CMS. And I saw it. I looked to see what type of bugs Craft CMS had the past 3-4 years.
And where did you look? Where did you look for that?
So I agree. I acted like a script kiddie because I didn't know. But then I think it got more. Where I looked over internet, there are CVEs for every application. You can search CVE, Craft CMS, and normally you find everything. And
that's on Meter, right? Is where you're looking at, cve.meter.org?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's for me, that's a good starting point. And
so if we go with the gold prospecting analogy, like this is your river, right? Mm-hmm. Where you start panning it. Okay.
It's like a discovery process. And mm-hmm. I found something like it was discovered 2 years ago. And I thought that maybe there is some other endpoints with that issue. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at Siomatic and I looked at the code and I was able to see all the endpoints which were authenticated. I dig through the code to understand a bit what's there.
Sure.
Yeah, that's how I found the issue. And that's when I contacted you.
Yep.
I created that CVE. I haven't made it public for like 3 months. It wasn't in my interest. And there are plenty of sites that had that issue. I even tried to contact a lot of them saying, look, you should update.
Right.
Good part is that many of them responded and took measures.
Mm.
And that's pretty much it.
Well, let me ask you a question. So you're saying you didn't publish this CVE. Mm-hmm. I've had a number of people contact me that they wanted to publish a CVE and they wanted me to do something to, you know, to say that they discovered it. Mm-hmm. What do they get out of that? Is it just a prestige thing? Can they use that to point to the stuff that they've discovered, or does that result in money, or what does that equate to? Because I had a hard time. I was contacted by a bunch of people and a lot of them seemed like nonsense. They didn't seem, they weren't even vulnerabilities and that they were mm-hmm. contacting me about. So it seemed like almost like a scam or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's a prestige thing. For me, I didn't, since I was doing it for the first time, that's the normal way to do it. If you find a bug, you create a CVE report. You don't need any permission. I mean, I was able to do it without you. I didn't want anything from you or stuff like that. But
yeah, I noticed that.
In my mind, the process was simple. Look, I create that, so it's tracked somewhere. And then I thought, look, 3 months, it should be plenty of time for people to update. And yeah, I haven't done anything there for, I think I found it in February, something like that. And there was some back and forth with the fixes. I think I contacted you several times.
Yeah.
But in the end, it got deployed. And I think sometime in May, I just put a note, basically, which was the vulnerable endpoint.
Right.
And I think in June or July, a lot of people started picking that up. And
it must have gotten published somewhere. I know like some of these quote unquote script kiddies, they put out YouTube videos and they, you know, there's probably some kind of underground Discord channel where they share all this stuff. You know, I'm sure all these things happen, but, and Ryan will get a kick out of this. So I was actually stuck in the, I didn't branch a particular thing that I was working on. So I couldn't get the security fix out as quickly as I wanted to. I still got it out pretty quickly, but I thought you would get a kick out of that, Ryan, that kind of mistaken workflow had affected me.
Haste makes waste. That's what my third grade teacher always said.
But so if I understand correctly, you found a critical vulnerability in SEOmatic. You notified Andrew about it. You notified some companies who were running Craft with that plugin about it. You waited a certain amount of time so people could address it. And then the information became public and then people started exploiting it. So the people who did not update SEOmatic would have been vulnerable. And I think I saw in a few cases of people who were hacked because of it because they didn't update in time.
That's right.
So for example, if you have a few dozen web apps out there that have dependencies, many dependencies, if you're, you know, a typical web developer, you're kind of just stitching dependencies together. What do you do? That's the whole topic for another.
we're all knitting a quilt and it's just dependencies.
I think everyone's just tab completing their entire apps now these days.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But the question is, well, do you check for every web app what vulnerabilities each plugin or dependency has? And how do you, I mean, that's so much work. How do you identify the critical path in that case?
Yeah, it's a good question. So to be honest, I even didn't heard about Craft CMS until this year. And that, I like that fact. I just read a bit about it. I like the concept and how it works compared with what I know, WordPress, for example. It's way better. And I said to myself, okay, let me see how does this work? And from the starting, yes, indeed, I installed Craft CMS on local, then I added plugins, I tried to play with them and see what endpoints they have, what can I input, what are the outputs, and then which requests are authenticated, which are not. Yeah, I think I reported some things to Craft CMS also, but they ignored them, which was not very cool, but yeah, that's a different other story.
Well, I think you were also very responsible in the way that you did it, right? So not only did you contact me, not only did you not use this information for your own personal whatever you'd want to do with it, but you also started contacting large companies that you found that had this thing running. So first of all, I'm curious, how did you find that they were using that particular thing? Like, how did you find these websites to begin with? What did you use there?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's pretty simple. If you look in the headers of Craft CMS, there is a header powered by Craft CMS or Seomatic, mm-hmm. something like that. And mm-hmm. there are crawlers like Shodan, for example, and they basically log just basic requests to the site, like a GET or a HEAD request. And they have a big database of sites. And you just search there for Seomatic and you can get tons of sites. And I think that's a good thing. I reported this to Craft CMS and they disabled that to do not be enabled by default. So I think that's one thing they did.
No, so I've got a question about that because this is something that I'm curious about. Because my understanding is, like, I understand that anything that you can use to fingerprint a website, I understand that that will help you a little bit from a security via through obscurity point of view. Yeah. Right. So, but also it's been drilled into my head that security through obscurity is not security, right? It's just obscuring it. And, and a lot of the scripts that I've seen, so we all see it. Like if we have a website and we look at the traffic logs in there, we see just a metric ass ton of logs of people hitting wp-admin.php, right? And it's not a WordPress site. There's nothing that identifies it as a WordPress site. So my understanding,
the rattling of the door handles.
Yeah.
Going up and down the street and checking to see if you can open their door.
Right. Well, and that's my understanding is that the way a lot of this works is an exploit is found. And then you have these spidering services that you can spin up that can look for that vulnerability. But my understanding about some of the ones that I've seen in terms of how they work is they don't even care about the header responses. They don't even look at that. They just go in and they try this, whatever the vulnerability du jour is. They just go in there and try it. Like they just blindly try it.
Yeah.
Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, I noticed that also. I mean, for me, it doesn't, maybe the idea here is that there are public word lists endpoints like WP admin and people just do random targets and hope something will be there. For me, it doesn't make sense to do that because I like more to look at one target and focus on that.
Right.
But people who have time to run scanners and look at the logs and do that, I don't find an interest in doing that.
Well, here's the fun thing. So we're all used to these crazy automation tools that we have, whether it's continuous integration, whether it's Ansible for deploying stuff, like all these crazy tools we have for automating things. Understand that a lot of these automation tools, or at least in the spirit of them, have also made it into the black hat world. And so my understanding about the way that some of this works is like a new security vulnerability is found, maybe it gets shared around, and sometimes there are local hacker discussions and on Discord, sometimes it's global, you know, whatever. But a new vulnerability is found. And what ends up happening is they plug that vulnerability into these spider things, right? And they just let it run. And it will come back and deliver to them a list of harvested results that they can just do stuff with. And that's why, I don't know, and maybe I'm just wrong on this, but that's why I don't love the idea of security through obscurity in terms of like disabling the header, but maybe it does at least get rid of the low hanging fruit. I mean, I don't know. Tell me, Eugene, you know, you're the one that does this for a living. Tell me.
No, I'm not doing it for a living. That's the whole point. I mean, I don't want to do it for a living.
Okay. But you are doing it from a capacity that people hire you to do this. No one's hiring me to do this. So tell me what your opinion is.
Yeah. My opinion is that I prefer to have one target. If I see that it's craft CMS, then I prepare a word list only with things related to craft CMS, and that's it. I mean, there is no point of flooding that server with useless requests. Mm-hmm. But I get your point. Disabling a header, it won't help on the big picture, because you still can get hit. But
well, and that's the main thing, is that was just my understanding. And from what I've seen, that's how these things work. Like, the vulnerability is found and they don't look for viable candidates. They just like crawl the internet the same way Google crawls it, because lots of people do this. They just turn off, you know, the Nginx fingerprints. They turn off headers that are coming in there, and they're like, okay, you know, it's kind of like in the horror movie where you hide in the cabinet somewhere and you're like, I hope he doesn't find me, but the guy with the knife always finds him.
You're right. I mean, headers aren't small thing that eventually will get hit. Actually, I was able to find a target that had those headers disabled.
Mm. How'd you do that?
How I did that? There was another thing in the header, something related to session cookie. So it's not only the header. I think the cookie has craft something in it. So that's another, I guess not everyone had thought about that.
You can disable headers, but then there are other ways it can be fingerprinted by the session cookie. Yeah. Craft even has, they call it craft session cookie, I think is what they name it. So that pretty clearly identifies it. Mm-hmm. You could obfuscate that, but then also if a bot really wanted to, it could look at the shape of the cookie and what's in it, and it could fingerprint it that way. I guess, you know, it's fine disabling this stuff as long as it doesn't make you complacent.
Yeah, in the end, you need to update. I mean, for me, it was hard to understand why it took for big companies that it took them 2 months to update one plugin. I don't understand this one. I mean, for the company I work, whenever I was able to find such thing in 1-2 days maximum, they solved it, because it's high risk. And that issue was with that issue, we can achieve remote code execution. We can download stuff on the server. I think Jennifer mentioned about Bitcoin miners and so on.
Yeah. Well, maybe Ryan can give us some insight here. So, Ryan, why might you know about a vulnerability but not update something immediately? Like, what would be the reasonings behind that?
That's a good question. I mean, it depends on your development workflow. You could have things like in queue to be launched. And last night we did a live stream. We talked about blocking the develop branch, you know, due to a Git workflow. Yep. And suddenly you have your develop branch all locked up. Granted, you know, there is this concept called a hotfix. So it's probably a pretty lame excuse. I can't really think of, like, I'm trying to think of a way to like justify someone not doing it other than just not getting to it, not hearing about it.
Well,
especially in with something like Craft, where, or with SEOmatic, where it really is just like a plugin update.
Right.
It's not like there's a library vulnerability that requires you to rewrite like vast amounts of code.
And
so
it
should be pretty straightforward, right? That's the advantage of something like Craft and the plugin architecture, is that you should just be able to update. But, you know, I think a lot of people are in the position with sites where A is that the site might be fairly complex to update because they don't update it often. So maybe they're several versions behind, and they're, in order to get that SEOmatic update, they would have to bump up some other things. It could be that a lot of companies use consultants to build websites. They may not have anyone on maintenance agreement. If you're a consultant, sell maintenance agreements. It's actually in the best interest of your clients.
Yeah.
So those companies might not know because they're not getting the emails. Maybe they didn't buy the licenses, right? I know that Craft sent out a whole bunch of notifications about it to people that actually had licenses, to be proactive about it. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons. I think the weakest point is probably, I mean, laziness, right? But also the real one are the people that use the consultant and just don't have anyone there to actually make those changes. And then you have to spin up a project. You have to So those would be mine.
I think some of it is probably human nature too, right? Like we're all inclined to believe like it's not going to happen to me.
Right.
You know, it's the same reason why you'll see people going around without masks on. You know what I mean? They're just like, well, I'm not going to get it. You know, that's something that
it's
other
invisible.
People get.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense. And I agree with you. I mean, it's something that I preach all the time, is that if you want to avoid issues, you should make the work updating should be small. Mm-hmm. And in order to make the work updating small, you have to update frequently. Because if the update is frequent, it's a very small thing that changes, and it's very easy if there's a problem to fix it. If you wait for 2 years, you haven't updated your site in 2 years, you haven't updated the operating system in 2 years, a security vulnerability comes out, it actually could be a nightmare to get everything updated, because then you've got dependencies upon dependencies, and the number of things that has changed grows astronomically to the point where it's like a web of connected things, and it's going to be much more difficult to do. Jennifer, you're nodding your head like you have encountered this.
Oh, no, I always update everything as soon as the updates come out.
Yeah.
But I was actually just thinking that from the developer's perspective, I mean, from the listeners, probably Craft CMS developers or similar who make a bunch of apps. Up until now, we've basically just told them that, well, all they have to do is update their plugins. I mean, there's a million other things that they need to do. The responsibility isn't just on Andrew to fix SEOmatic and for us to update. There's so many other ways that our web apps need to be hardened that we can't just rely on Craft and on the plugin developers to make sure that they're hardened.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you, in your experience, if you've seen any vulnerabilities that are the most common. I mean, one thing out of the box, we can just tell people to not use WordPress and that'll solve 90% of your problems. but I mean, is remote code execution really that common? Or is it SQL injection attacks, cross-site scripting? In your experience, what do we need to look out for in our day-to-day coding experience? We're just making web apps for clients.
I think remote code execution is like the top end. I mean, if you get that, it's game over. But I wouldn't focus too much on the SQL injections. I think the libraries that are being used now, it's pretty tough to achieve SQL injection.
But that used to be a big thing, right? It used to be like you would see SQL injections all over the place, but it sounds like the response happened where there's just like, okay, now we know what we need to do as a best practice to prevent that. Is that right?
Correct. And I think nowadays there are vulnerabilities like server-side template injections, like the one I found. This one is like, I think it's a newer method. It has only 2-3 years, I think. But I don't know. I think you shouldn't look at a method. You should be aware that whenever you input something, you should think, oh, okay, I'm coding this part, then I should think a bit. You don't need to spend too much time, but I bet that if every developer will spend like 2 hours beginning of the project to increase awareness of things that can happen, it would be good. And I think another important aspect is to have security people in the development process. I mean, not like developing, but for the company I work, it's helpful to have another set of eyes looking at those aspects.
Right.
It's tough. I mean, I saw a lot of cases where companies don't really want to involve security people on this, but whenever something bad happens, oh, look, we needed that, so...
Right.
It will change. I think in a couple of years, security will be part of the development process more and more.
Mm. But is that just an arms race? You know, I mean, is it? Because I would think that software being software, in that it's so complicated and it's only getting more and more complicated, as Jennifer pointed out, that we're stitching together packages. Like if something in the base level that tons of people are using, they end up finding some kind of an exploit in, like there are going to be a whole lot of websites and applications that are going to be completely screwed. And there's lots of layers in that can happen. Is it an arms race that's ever going to end in terms of we're going to feel more comfortable, or is it just going to escalate up and up?
You know? I think it takes time, as it happened with the SQL injections. When a couple of years ago, there were plenty. Every site had that issue. But now it's, I think there is a top 10 vulnerabilities, WOWASP. And there you can see that in the past years, SQL injections haven't been so important. I mean, it's reduced the attack. And I bet it will happen the same with whatever methods are this year or whatever methods are found.
But then they move on to something else.
Yes.
I feel like, this is my personal view, but I feel like as long as there is money involved,
exactly,
people are going to find ways. Like if there's a lot of money involved to be gained in locking up an entire city's computer systems and holding mm-hmm. them ransom for millions mm-hmm. of dollars, people are going to put a lot of effort into trying to figure out ways to do that.
And you know? No repercussions. I mean, it's just, right. that's exactly. There's very little deterrence to do this.
Right.
So maybe to share a story. So yeah. I think last year there was a method found that allows you to add an extra header to the request, mm-hmm. like let's say content type or content length. You okay. double that header, and with this method you were able to trick the server to respond you with an internal endpoint. I'm just giving the big picture.
Yep.
And I think from last year and this year, there are a lot of big sites vulnerable to that. Hmm. And already this year, you won't find such targets because the measures were already taken and they were in place. I think it will happen the same with whatever will happen. But yeah, methods will appear. And unfortunately, you won't be able to protect from everything.
We've even seen stuff like the FBI has reportedly paid money to some underground organization for a hack that will let them exploit a specific iPhone version mm-hmm. to hack into it and get into there. You know what I mean? So it's not even just, it's just whenever there is a sufficient motivation, whether that mm-hmm. is money or something else, like people are going to put a lot of effort into it. And it feels like, you're right, whatever people were doing this year, next year, they're not going to be doing that because we will have solved for that. But they'll be on to the next thing, I feel like, mm-hmm. you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, it's good for you from a job security point of view, right? There'll be always more.
I think it's a good place to be in this year's and the next years that will come.
So what do you think, Jennifer? You do a lot of sensitive work. Do you have any questions for Eugene that you want to get out there? Like, have you ever thought about, for instance, as part of your development process, getting someone in there at that point? Or do you wait until a little bit further along? Or how does it work for you?
We don't, during the development process, other than consult our own experience and read online about what we should be watching out for, we use Acunetic. Mm-hmm. They have software that will do penetration testing and they release reports. We attend a few webinars on the topic. I mean, we have a lot to do. We should develop more time. We should put in more time to this, but unfortunately we can't. I'd love to have someone come in and look at everything and make sure that we're doing things properly, but it's also quite expensive. So we're trying to allocate resources best we can. But I mean, I can say that the things we try to hammer down our servers to make sure that we immediately block people who are trying to access the WP admin. We lock people out. We even lock out our own clients if they try for five password attempts, and we'll lock them out. We require them to change their passwords, even though they hate us for it. Too bad. They need to be responsible for this sensitive data too.
Right.
We do things. We respond to the reports that we get. For example, this was 10 years ago, but at one point it was found that people could, if they wanted to, in the file uploads, execute PHP files. So we locked that down, sort of a rookie error there. We also anonymize data before we even look at it. And some data fields, we try not to store sensitive data, but if we have to, we have that encrypted. And we don't allow even team members to access that data. It's all scrambled and anonymous. We back everything up all the time, log things on the servers, and we buy insurance. So if we get hacked, whose fault is it? We try to make sure that, we're not going to go bankrupt because some goon broke into our house and took our stuff. So that's about all we do. I'm sure I'm missing a bunch of stuff. I'd love to have the expert go in and tell us the 20 things we're missing, but that's probably it for now.
I think two things I would recommend: to introduce security as part of the development, plus do, I don't know if you have CI/CD pipelines, but there should be some static analysis on the code. So as
like sooner, Scrutinizer or Travis or Circle or one of those. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But there are tools that do static analysis from the security perspective. And if you run those in your pipelines, I think it's good. And another suggestion would be to start a bug bounty program. I mean, you don't need to pay the guys. You make it private, and you invite only a couple of kids, or I don't know. But those will put the time, and I think on the long term, it will help. It won't protect you 100% to have bug bounty program, but you still need to take proper measures. But I think it's good just because whoever does bug bounty is aware of new things that pop up.
I love the idea of having unpaid labor. It sounds good.
Well, I think you got to pay the bounty. I think that's the whole point.
You can give them swags or like it might be...
What, like a Starbucks gift card? What are you
doing? Yeah, you can buy, buy them coffee. You can, there are... People respect that, from the bug bounty community.
Yeah. Both of you made a really interesting point that I'm going to try to tie it together. So, Jennifer, obviously you're a professional and you try to use best security practices everywhere you can. But ultimately, if it's not in the client budget, you can't justify spending that time, right? So, and this gets back to also what you were saying, Eugene, is like you're shocked that it took these large companies months to update stuff. I mean, at some point, we're going to do the best that we can do. And it reminds me of web performance, for instance. Like no one wants to put out a site that doesn't perform well. But if there's no client budget for it, there's no client budget. We can do our best. We try to sell them on it. Web performance matters. We try to sell them on it. Information security matters. Like we should devote this amount of budget to the security part of the process. And we try to pitch it to them. But if they don't pay the money, is it our fault? What do you think, Jennifer?
If they don't pay the money, is it our fault?
You know what I mean? Like the budget isn't coming from the client, like you're obviously not going to be irresponsible, but if they're not paying you to do the kind of real probing that you feel you should be doing, like what can you do?
Yeah, I think there's some balance there. I think when we offer a client a product and we're going to create a case management system for your social workers, for example, they are going to be able to pay a certain amount. And we're going to be able to put in a certain amount of time. And I can't tell them that, you're not paying enough, so your data is not safe.
Right.
I have to be able to reassure them that we're doing these 20 things to keep your data safe. And here are the 10 things that you can do. And it's never guaranteed that it will be safe, but we think that we're doing a reasonable amount. And it's never going to be fully safe, as we talked about. There's always going to be someone who's going to be able to hack in. So there just has to be an agreement on what's reasonable. And I think that it's hard for clients to understand that.
Right.
I don't want to say, you need to spend an extra $20,000 on this thing, because I don't think that they'll really get it. That they all say, that's so expensive. That doesn't make sense. So it's sort of a cost that we eat, because I don't want to tell them that they need to pay for security. They expect it. It's like building them a house and saying, you got to pay for the security guard. Well, what do you mean? Like, you put locks on the house, right?
Well, also, ironically, if you do your job well, and also if Eugene does his job well, nobody notices. Right. So the idea is, if you have done a good job with the security, nobody, like, it's almost as if it
right,
never
yeah.
happened.
It's not like I was going to be the contrarian and say, we don't have to pitch the client on the idea of building like a CSS file that's going to show the design. Right.
Yeah.
So I think, and I say this like, semi-seriously, but also understanding like the realities of the consulting business, but also that to answer your original question, Andrew, I do think it's actually on the consultants. I don't think it's on the consultants to deliver something that is 100% risk-free. I think that's, as Jen said, that's why we have insurance and other.
It also doesn't exist.
Right. But it is on us to actually know how to sell projects in a way that where you're putting like the project forward in a way that you think is the best fit.
Like if you owned a paint store, you don't sell anyone any lead paint.
Right. Or even different, you don't sell products that you don't think are good, right? Like you wouldn't sell crap paint and foam brushes. Sorry for big foam brush, but you wouldn't sell that kind of stuff if you don't think it's a good way of applying the paint and getting the optimum result.
Why are you talking bad about Walmart?
I have foam brushes in my garage. They're great for.
No, you say don't
Danish
buy
oil.
Crap product, but you, I mean, it sounds like you're.
Yeah, no,
sounds
I mean,
like you're targeting
Walmart. I didn't say anything like that, but, but I do think it's important to, if you're a company that security, when you're building sites for clients and security is really important, then that gets built into the budget. Maybe there's somewhere else that you can like cut to make that more important. In general, I think that we vastly undersell the services that we provide. So, mm-hmm. and maybe this becomes one of the other things. I mean, we have a whole generation of front-end developers that now demand more than some of the most seasoned back-end developers. I mean, like, I feel like we can fit in security. So yeah, if it's a priority.
Well, let me ask you an ethical question then.
Yeah, I'm afraid what I've just opened myself up to. Go ahead.
I'm going
to
ask you, well, yeah, you know what? I'm going to ask you this too. So let's say that you've got a family to feed and you're an independent developer, you're a consultant, and a company comes to you and they want you to build this site and it deals with sensitive information. And you tell them, you know, it's going to cost you $30,000 to build this site. And they see a line item on there mm-hmm. for $10,000 that's security auditing and hardening and that kind of stuff. And they come back to you and they say, this is great, Ryan, but we don't care about the security. Chop that off. Will you do it for $20,000, even though you feel it would be completely irresponsible with the data that people are going to be putting in there if you did it that way? Ryan first.
I would not. And if for some reason I had to, there would be an extended waiver that they would have to sign that I am absolved of all,
right.
all responsibility. But no, probably not. I mean, that would be like saying, like when I did a lot of consulting, I always, it's like with payment terms, right? I think a good way to go is half in the beginning, half in 45 days, regardless of the length of the project, something like that, mm-hmm. right? It's pretty aggressive, but it's just like you set your line in the sand for what really matters to you and for your business. And if security is that, then no, I wouldn't do it.
But you've got a child and you don't want them to go hungry and you don't know where the food is going to be coming from. If you don't take this job, you still are going to say no?
I'm still going to say no, but okay. I would say no. But again, I'm saying that from
a position of privilege,
an extremely
Ryan.
Fortunate position to even have that take. But yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All right. What do you think? What do you think, Jennabel? I'm asking you the same question. You got a 30K job coming in. They want to cut the 10K off, which is the security penetration, testing, auditing, that kind of stuff that you feel it really needs because it's dealing with sensitive, you know, information, maybe kids, that type, credit cards, you know, whatever is considered super sensitive, and you've got to pay your rent in New York City for your luxurious penthouse suite apartment that you've got. Do you take the job?
You know, technically this is a penthouse.
I can tell.
So interesting. It's an interesting question. I'm trying to think if I'd ever be in that scenario. I think the answer is probably no, because it's not just it. What about the kids? What about their data? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to do that to children. I don't want their data exposed on the internet. I wouldn't want this client to go to anyone else and have them do it for that. So maybe all I'd right. be a sucker and do it for 20 and give them the thing that they need if I'm being a, you know, Mother Teresa sort.
Right.
No, I try not. I don't work with clients unless we're.
But couldn't you rationalize it? Couldn't you rationalize it being like, well, things will probably be okay.
No, not with sensitive data, not with children data, or not with stuff on. Like I work with women centers that serve women who are in halfway houses. There's absolutely no way I'm going to let anyone find out the locations of those. It's just right. never going to happen.
Right.
I wouldn't work with a client like that. And I guess I'm lucky enough that I have the ability to say no to clients. I think that's where I would draw the line, is doing things that I think is unethical.
Yeah. And you said, well, maybe someone else will do it, right? So, you know, you can't be thinking about things that you don't control. The only thing you can do is saying, I am not going to make this world worse. You know, yeah. Someone else might, but I'm not going to, you know, that's my opinion anyway. Yep. But I agree with you. I agree with you on that. But I think that about wraps it up for another episode of the devmode.fm podcast. To have every episode sent to your podcast player, subscribe via RSS or iTunes. And we'd love to continue the conversation. Leave us a comment on the devmode.fm website or find us on Twitter at devmode.fm. For the devmode.fm podcast, I'm Andrew Welch.
I'm Jennifer Bloomberg.
I'm Ryan Ireland.
And thank you, Eugene, for coming on.
Thank you also.
Yes, I know that's the wrong music. I'm going to have to go back in and edit it anyway.
I can't hear it this time either.
You can't hear it? Okay. Well, maybe there's... Oh, God.
I don't know.
Hopefully everything worked all right. But that was really fun, Eugene. I enjoyed that. What did you guys think? Did you enjoy it, Jennifer?
Yeah, very much. It's an interesting topic. I think we should talk about it more. There's so many other things we could go into, more on the social engineering side of it. And also we could go through the list of the specific things that developers always screw up. Like that would be really helpful for people. I think it's worth a version two, I think.
The social engineering thing I was going to bring up, but Andrew, your question about why don't people update? I mean, there's a little bit of the social engineering there too, right? Of not just trying to trick people, but why don't